Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. This morning, in this hour, we will have the third in a series of conversations, three conversations, looking at the politics of the Middle East. And what we tried to do was select three guests that we thought would have distinctly different points of view. The first conversation last week was with Israel's Consul General to the Midwest, Baruch Pinah, the closest we thought probably we could come to have somebody who would be officially representing the government of Israel to talk with. Yesterday on this program, we talked with Zev Maus, who's a professor of political science and director of the International Relations Program at the University of California, Davis, the two of them having very different perspectives on Israeli policy in the Middle East, particularly regarding the Palestinians. And we had, with both of them, spent quite a lot of time talking about the war that Israel fought this past summer in southern Lebanon against Hezbollah. Well, this morning we'll have another conversation with another guest who I expect, again, will have a different sort of view on these same subjects. Our guest in this hour is Rashid Khalidi. He holds the Edward Said Chair in Arab Studies at Columbia University. Previously, he was Professor of Middle East History and Director of the Center for International Studies at the University of Chicago, where he taught from 1987 until 2003. He has written many articles and several books about the Middle East. His most recent, newly published, is entitled The Iron Cage, The Story of the Palestinian Struggle for Statehood. It's published by the Beacon Press, and it's an attempt to provide some sort of context for where we are now by going back and taking a look at Palestinian efforts to establish a state in the period before 1948. So you might seek out that book. He is also the author of the book Resurrecting Empire, Western Footprints and America's Perilous Path in the Middle East. It was published in 2004, and another entitled Palestinian Identity, The Construction of Modern National Consciousness. He is joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455 for folks here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. That's for anybody else. So if it would be a long-distance call for you, you may use the toll-free line and the calls on us. Otherwise, if you are here in Champaign-Urbana, again, 333-9455. That's the number. We certainly encourage people to call with questions, comments. The only thing we ask is please for callers to be brief and make sure that you leave a lot of time for all the other people who would also like to call in. Professor Khalidi, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us once again. We appreciate it.
Pleasure to be with you again.
I certainly want to give you the opportunity to talk about the Iron Cage, mm-hmm. but I also am interested in having you talk about where things stand at the moment. And since in the conversations I mentioned with the other two guests, we spent a lot of time talking about the war that, as I said, the war that Israel fought against Hezbollah mm-hmm. in this past summer, I'll ask you a question about that and ask, you may have some things to say about that. Particularly, though, I'm interested in that and what that has to do, or does that have anything to do, have any impact on the conflict between Israel and Palestinians?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there is at least a nominal connection in that the Hezbollah leader, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, explicitly said that one of the reasons that his movement launched the operation, which led to the capture of these two Israeli soldiers on the 12th of July, was to relieve the Israeli pressure on Gaza. Most people in the United States wouldn't know what we're talking about when I say that, because it really hasn't gotten much coverage, except occasionally when the death toll goes above 10 or 20. But since May, something like nearly 400 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza. And several Israelis, I think a third Israeli civilian was killed this morning by rocket fire coming out of Gaza. So there's been ongoing violence there. Most of the people killed, the overwhelming majority of the people killed, over 300 as against 3, being Palestinians. And he said, at least, Nasrallah, that one of the reasons that they launched this operation was to relieve the pressure on Gaza. So there's that connection, if no other.
Just let me ask about one other thing now, and that is the continuing sort of stalemate, standoff, difficult negotiations, whatever you want to call it, involving the leadership of Hamas on one mm-hmm. hand and Fatah on the other, mm-hmm. that we have within now on the Palestinian side this division between the more old-line leaders,
right,
and they're represented by Mahmoud Abbas, and the Hamas people who came in this last election. Obviously, there were a lot of people on the Palestinian side were unhappy with, dissatisfied with the old leadership.
Right.
And so they were saying was, well, we're not sure what about these new guys, but at least we think a change is in order. So they voted
right.
for this new government.
And right.
and then now, though we have this, it seems almost paralyzed because we have these two opposing groups that can't quite seem how to see the way to sort themselves out.
Mm-hmm.
Now the former Hamas president has said, well, all right, I'll step down.
Prime Minister,
because Mr. Abbas, he's the president.
Right.
So he's said he's going to step aside. Someone new has been named. Is that actually going to make any difference?
I don't know if it'll make a difference. A lot will depend on how brain-dead American policy continues to be on this issue. And a lot will depend on whether the Palestinians can get their act together and can actually bring about this compromise. It looks like it's on the point of taking place, but we have yet to see whether it will. What you've got there are two different things, both a struggle for power between these factions, Fatah and Hamas, one of which controls the presidency, which it won an election. So Abu Mazen is the elected president of the Palestinian Authority, and one of which controls the parliament and therefore the government and the prime minister, which it won in a later election back in January, the one you were referring to, in which I think the primary drive of the voters was to throw the bums out and to teach Fatah a lesson for its corruption and its ineptitude. And that's one thing that we have. The second thing that we have is a serious constitutional crisis, because this is an entirely new political system, and it's not clear where authority resides as between the presidency and the agencies that the presidency controls, among them the security forces, and to some extent foreign policy, and as between the government, which is responsive to parliament, which is dominated by Hamas. So it's both a political crisis and a constitutional crisis, in a sense, sort of like the situation you had of so-called cohabitation between a right-wing French president, Chirac, and a socialist prime minister, Jospin, back a few years ago.
Do you think, looking at the people on the Hamas side, that they would be any better able to move things along to deal with the problems of the Palestinians, trying to address people's daily needs, to improve people's lives any better than the old leadership, the Fatah people?
Well, you know, the voters seem to think so, and that's why I think they threw the bums out. They felt that Fatah had shown corruption and ineptitude, and they felt that Hamas had, by its social services, by its relative absence of corruption, shown that it might do a better job. But I think that many people may well have been disappointed over the past eight or nine months since the January elections. Partly this had nothing to do with Hamas. It had to do with the boycott immediately imposed after the government was formed by the United States, the EU, and Israel. But partly it did have to do with Hamas. They clearly could not, among themselves, within Hamas, decide whether they would go along with the so-called prisoners document in May, which would have involved a compromise with Fatah and which would have involved them ceding some of their power and compromising on some of their hardline positions, which some leaders of Hamas clearly were willing to do, including the entire leadership of the Hamas prisoners in Israeli jails, and which some clearly were not willing to do, including the hardline leadership in Damascus headed by Khalid Mash'al. So one of the things that has transpired over these past few months is that Hamas, to some extent, has been paralyzed by its own internal differences and hasn't looked a whole lot better than Fatah. In that regard,
it's something that doesn't seem likely to change, at least according to now some of the stories that I have read here, quotes coming out from people speaking for Hamas, is that no matter what it is that this unity government manages to agree to, recognition of Israel will not be part of it.
That's the position of Hamas. The weird thing here is what Hamas is saying is that Hamas won't recognize Israel. They're not saying that a government that they support might not.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be very peculiar if this transpires. What you will have is a Hamas majority in the Palestinian Legislative Council supporting a government which may accept the Oslo agreements on the basis of which the authority was constituted, may accept to hold violence, and may accept, you know, to deal with Israel in a way that Hamas continues to say. You're right, this is what they're saying. But what they're saying is Hamas will never recognize Israel. You may have this peculiar disconnect whereby a government that they at least nominally support is doing things that they don't support. And then the question will be, what will be the reaction of the international community?
Well, I would expect that the reaction of the Israelis would be, well, we don't, in a sense, they would say, as far as we're concerned, nothing has really changed here, as long as there is Hamas involved at all, and that the official position of Hamas is that we're not going to accept the existence of Israel, then it doesn't seem to me that there's any place to go there.
Well, there may or may not be. I mean, if the if the Europeans, for example, who seem to be more amenable to accepting this kind of, you know, round the back of your head, scratching your left ear with your right hand type of approach, if the Europeans go along with that and funds start to flow, then I'm not sure the boycott will hold. Moreover, if the administration, the U.S. administration, decides that, you know, peace talks are more important than purity, and that dropping what I was very much criticized once for calling a 12-year-old adolescent girl's approach to foreign policy, I don't like you and I won't talk to you, which seems to be the animating principle of the Bush administration foreign policy in the Middle East. If they can get over that, then they may find that there is actually something to talk to about, to a government, even a government supported by Hamas, about, like a long-term ceasefire and like some kind of negotiation of a two-state settlement, which apparently Hamas, even though it makes these ringing statements, is prepared in some way to accept, or at least some leaders of Hamas appear to be prepared to accept.
Is that, and you think even though publicly they're saying that they're not, you think privately, in fact,
well, you know, there's no they. You act as if this is a monolithic, or people act as if this is a monolithic organization. Hamas leaders have said things all over the map, including some of their most important leaders who are now dead, people who've been assassinated by the Israelis, like Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. And I think you have to take that full range of opinions and the fact that they are deeply divided into account. What seems to me to be happening is that the hardline types are in the ascendant right now, or have been in the ascendant until recently. But they're not the only ones in Hamas. I think that's important to see.
I guess to me, I wonder, does there ever come a time when enough people in Hamas actually say, in an open sort of way, something that maybe they say to themselves or say privately, and that is, there's simply no way that we're going to defeat Israel by force of arms.
Some of them have said that publicly. The problem is they don't yet represent either a majority within Hamas, nor, I think, is that enough to go on for them to say, even if they say it publicly, as some of their leaders have said. I mean, there are several West Bank Hamas leaders who have said things along those lines. But I don't think that, I think that Hamas is really, I keep using this expression, got to get their act together. They have to decide where they stand on some of these issues. Because Palestinian public opinion does not stand with them on this issue. Palestinians did not vote for the Hamas charter, did not vote for the destruction of Israel and the creation of an Islamic Palestine, did not vote for any of those things. They voted for the Hamas platform, which was reform and change. It downplayed all of the things that I've just mentioned. And it was essentially, you know, we're better than the other guys who are incompetent and corrupt. And that's why people voted for them. And that's the only reason they have a majority today.
Yeah. Maybe one further question, and then I have callers we'll go to. And you have said, and quite rightly so, that you should be careful talking about Hamas as being a kind of a monolithic or entity organization, because there are individuals who are all over the place.
Leaders.
Leaders.
Right.
And that would suggest that for any government, there's always... It sounds as if it would be virtually impossible for any government to have complete control over anybody who would want to do anything, particularly commit some kind of violent act against
Israelis. Yeah, but
that's
something that they're going to have to figure out how to do, because otherwise the thing won't last.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is going to be very hard, I think.
Our guest is Rashid Khalidi. He is a professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University and has written a great deal about the politics of the Middle East and of the history of the Palestinian movement. His brand new book is titled The Iron Cage, The Story of the Palestinian Struggle for Statehood, which takes a look at the period before 1948. If you're interested, you can look for it in the bookstore. Questions are welcome here too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have several calls. And we'll start in with line number one in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Rashid, this is Francis Boyle over here at the College of Law in Champaign.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And I wanted to call and wish you best wishes on Palestine Independence Day.
Well,
as
thank
you. Know,
you.
On 15 November 1988, the Palestine National Council in Algiers proclaimed the independent state of Palestine. And that state is now recognized de jure by 130 states in the world. It has de facto legal recognition by all members of the European Union. And the only reason that Palestine does not have de jure recognition from the European Union is of pressure applied upon them by the United States. In addition, which, by the way, now President Bush has at least said that there should be a Palestinian state.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In addition, the state of Palestine has de facto UN membership. Palestine can do everything at the UN but vote. And the only thing keeping Palestine out of UN membership is the threat of a United States veto. Of course, Israel refuses to recognize de jure the Palestinian state. However, even Ariel Sharon, when he was prime minister, stated in the Knesset that the Palestinians already have their state, and that really what we're talking about now, this is my interpretation, he said that. What we're basically talking about now is what type of state that is going to be. And I think people have to understand this in the colloquy you had with the interviewer, that in fact Israel refuses to recognize the Palestinian state, despite the fact that almost the entire world recognizes the Palestinian state. And indeed, in the advisory proceedings before the International Court of Justice on Israel's apartheid wall, the World Court invited the state of Palestine to participate in these proceedings. So there's a high degree of international recognition for this Palestinian state that started out 18 years ago today. And right now, the only denier really is Israel. Thank you.
All right. Well, Professor Khalidi, you can comment on that any way you like.
Well, just a quick comment. As Francis Boyle, who's a professor of law, knows better than I do, what that state lacks is a territory on which to exercise its sovereignty, because under the Oslo Accords, the accords that were signed in 1993, the Palestinian Authority that was then created had neither sovereignty nor jurisdiction, nor for that matter really control, even over the territory that Israel at that stage temporarily evacuated. It retook most of those territories in 2002. So that is a problem. I argue in my book, in The Iron Cage, that another problem has been a failure to build up by the Palestinians, to build up structures of state. So I would criticize the way in which the PLO leadership negotiated the Oslo Accords, which gave them a shell without any substance. And I would criticize also the failures to create more substantive structures of state, even in the territories where the Palestinian Authority operated, even though it didn't have sovereignty and jurisdiction and a full measure of control. But Francis Boyle is right. I mean, the state of Palestine was proclaimed 18 years ago today in Algiers in a declaration which, incidentally, was constituted the Palestinian recognition of Israel. That declaration has not been superseded.
All right. Well, we'll continue. We'll go next to our caller on line 3, and this would be someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. Am I on?
Yes.
Yes. I have a question that I ask, not in any sense of hostility, but I really want the information. One of the arguments, or a train of argument I've heard, is that from 1947, when the United Nations partitioned the Palestinian and an Israeli state, and Israeli accepted it and the Palestinians didn't, that there's been a rejectionist ideology and a rejectionist from the Palestinians, mm-hmm. who do not recognize the existence of Israel. That all the way up to the present, where Gaza is now, the Israelis have left for 15 months, and Palestinians still lob lob rockets into Israel. After the 1967 war, when Israel agreed to give the territories back, and the group, the Arab states in Khartoum, said no. So there's no negotiation. So I wondered how. Now I realize that the Israelis and Hamas and the Palestinians are not monolithic, but I would appreciate your view on that perspective.
Okay, well, a bunch of things. I mean, you've touched on, you know, about nine of the greatest shibboleths around. Israel did not agree to give back the territories in 1967. That was not the Israeli position. It was willing to negotiate in some cases, but it was not willing to give back most of the territories, and it was only with great difficulty that Egypt and Israel many, many years later were able to negotiate peace treaties with Israel, in which Israel did give back a territory to Egypt. Jordan, there was no territory to give back. The West Bank, the Jordanians had given up their claim to that. You are right. After 1947, the Palestinians did reject the partition resolution, as did the Arab states, with the partial exception of Jordan, which really did accept it, Transjordan. They did that because the Palestinians were two-thirds of the population and were to be given 45% of the country. They felt it was manifestly unjust. The Palestinians understood Palestine as their own country. And you're absolutely right. They did reject the partition. What then happened, I think, should be looked at very carefully, though, because even though Israel accepted the partition, it did not accept the frontiers of partition and ended up with much larger frontiers as a result of the war that followed. The other point that I think is worth saying is that the Arab countries in different ways and at different times have accepted the existence of the State of Israel. Egypt and Jordan accepted it by their acceptance of Security Council Resolution 242, and then more and more explicitly, and now they have peace treaties with Israel. Syria accepted it when it accepted Security Council Resolution 338 in 1973. And all of the Arab governments are on record at Arab summits as saying, we are perfectly willing to accept the existence of Israel as long as it returns the occupied territories occupied in 1967. And as you heard from the last caller, as Professor Boyle pointed out, and as I stressed in what I said in response to him, in 1988, when the Palestine National Council meeting in Algiers declared Palestinian independence, it did so on the basis of Palestinian acceptance, many decades later, obviously, of that General Assembly resolution which created an Arab and a Jewish state, and that was the Palestinian acceptance of Israel. So this statement that the Palestinians have never accepted Israel, it certainly was true of the partition. The Palestinians did not accept the partition plan. But it is no longer true, and it hasn't been true for 18 years.
Could I ask a follow-up? If there are so many statements coming out of the Palestinians, of Hamas, of not accepting Israel,
mm-hmm.
If I was an Israeli, I would be kind of scared of that. You know?
Well, the thing that I would be scared of if I was an Israeli would be the fact that for 40 almost of its 65 years, Israel has ruled over another people, denying them their rights, and that has created, among other things, Hamas. There was no Hamas in 1967.
Yeah, but no,
there was no Hamas in 1977. Hamas grew up in 1987 after 20 years of occupation, and it has grown more virulent and more uncompromising ever since. I would look at the creation, at the condition which Israel has imposed on the Palestinians for four decades nearly, for two and a half generations, for two-thirds of the life of the State of Israel, something that most Israelis just don't think about very much and people in the United States are completely ignorant of, is that this massive denial of rights and the systematic violence that's necessary to enforce the unwanted rule of one people over another has created a lot of hatred, a lot of anger, and really the only way to deal with that is to figure out a way to dismantle the matrix of control over the occupied territories. There's no other way. It's absolutely the essential avenue to solving things, in my view. There are a lot of other problems, and I know that one of them has to do with mutual non-recognition. A lot of Israelis don't really recognize the Palestinians, even though the Israeli government has recognized the Palestinians. And a lot of Palestinians don't recognize Israel, even though the PLO has recognized it. But I would suggest that this matrix of control that Israel is suffocating, matrix of control over almost 4 million people, for going on 40 years now, something which is systematically obscured from our view in this country. I mean, you're almost called an anti-Semite if you talk about it, or you're told that's not what's really important. What's really important is Arab-Jew hatred or Arab anti-Semitism, Arab refusal to accept Israel. And I mean, these things exist certainly, but I would suggest that this thing that you're encouraged not to look at might in fact be a lot more important than many people think.
Should I stop, David? Or
well, I do have two other people that I'd like to get in. Well, thanks very much for the call. Let me, Professor Khalidi, for a moment, I want to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about the Iron Cage.
Yeah, and, which we haven't done yet.
Which we haven't. And specifically because I think a lot of people will point out, as you do in your introduction, that some people would say that there have been so many forces arrayed against the Palestinians, mm-hmm. so many people working against them and against Palestinian statehood going back all the way to 1948, that some people would say, you know, why concentrate on failures on the Palestinian side when, in fact, they had so much going against them?
Right.
That's essentially the question you set up in the introduction of the book.
Right.
What's the answer to that? Yeah.
Well, it's a question I ask there so that I can give you the answer, which is essentially I don't ignore all of these constraints on the Palestinians or the unfavorable balance of forces that they faced. But what I try and talk about in this book is that the Palestinians, first of all, have to be seen as having had agency and have to be understood as having had choices and having choices. You may be weak, but that doesn't mean you're just a victim. You may have bad choices, but you still have choices. And what I'm trying to get at is a sort of cult of victimhood, which a lot of Palestinians wallow in, which I think is quite harmful. And it's harmful to understanding as well as harmful to understanding the past and the present as well as to understanding what to do about them. And so what I try and do in the book is show various points where, in fact, the Palestinians had more assets than sometimes understood to be the case, or had choices which people maybe don't pay full attention to, and how badly or well they chose at those decisive points has something to do with where we are today. I mean, it's not really pointing a finger of blame at people or anything of that sort, whether I'm talking about the constraints on the Palestinians by the British or by the United States or by Israel or by the Arab states, or whether I'm pointing at the Palestinians' actions, but it is rather correctly assessing what actually happened, which I don't think is often done in a lot of the histories.
Well, this you do cover a lot of history in this book. Is it possible to point to any particular key turning points where mm-hmm. you might say, if at this point the Palestinians had done something different instead of what they did, things today might be very different?
Yeah, a couple of things. Back in the Mandate, which is what, you know, about two-thirds or a little more than half of the book is about, the period up to 1948, I think the Palestinians had a variety of chances in the 20s and the 30s, either to more resolutely oppose the British or to figure out some kind of compromise with the Zionist movement before it became overwhelmingly strong following the rise to power of Hitler in 1933. I think that was the key turning point in Palestinian history, and the Palestinian revolt that followed 1936-39 and then the catastrophe of the Palestinians of 1947-48 were, in a sense, followed on things that could have been changed, perhaps, by Palestinian, different Palestinian actions back in the 20s and the early 30s. So that's one instance. Another instance I talk about in the book is things that the PLO could have done to negotiate more effectively, and in particular, in various times in the 80s especially, but in particular to negotiate more effectively during the negotiations that started at Madrid, went on in Washington, and then were followed by secret negotiations in Oslo and elsewhere. I think they did a terrible job there, and I go into it in the book, and I think there were choices they made, admittedly under compulsion, but which were, in my view, often the wrong choices.
Mm. I think, you know, often when you hear people who are speaking for either side and they address failures, it seems almost without exception, they say, well, the problem is the other side.
Yeah.
And refusal to bargain in good faith. Now, I was struck yesterday by when our conversation with Zev Maus, that I thought he was rather candid in saying, well, in fact, if there has been failure along down through the years in these talks, that it's not just has not just been a Palestinian failure. It has been a failure on both sides.
Yeah.
That's a candid admission. I'm not exactly sure where that gets us, though, other than saying, well, there have indeed been failures on both sides, and there probably have been there certainly have been sides when representatives of both sides did not bargain in good faith.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I mean, I'm a Palestinian American. My family's from Palestine. I was born here, but I obviously have feelings in this, but I don't see myself as a in this book, certainly, as writing as a spokesperson or an advocate, I'm writing history. I'm trying to write, you know, Palestinian history. I'm trying to write what I think is a neglected narrative. I'm trying to show people that they're not going to understand their own history if they're other Arabs or Israelis or people trying to understand America's role in this region, if they don't understand this narrative, which is very rarely paid seriously attention. Very rarely is serious attention paid to it. Very rarely is it understood properly. But I think that while what you said is true, and in my book I focus largely on Palestinian actions or failures or choices, I think that to ignore the balance of forces is folly. To not understand how powerful the British were in Palestine and the actions they took, or to understand how powerful our country has been in the Middle East really for the past 60 years, or to understand how the Palestinian National Movement had to swim against this really negative tide in the Arab world, in the period from the 50s onwards, to not understand those things, to not see the constraints and the balance of forces, is also a mistake. I mean, to look at the Palestinians and the Israelis as if they're on an equal level when one people is occupying the entirety of the territory of the other is ridiculous. I mean, they are not states, and they're not equal actors, and they're not on an equal playing field. One is a nuclear superpower. You know, people in America think of Israel as tiny and weak and so on and so forth. That's not the way it's looked at in the Middle East. It's looked at as a very powerful state. It flies over any Arab capital it chooses to and acts with impunity in those capitals, blowing people up and so on and so forth. And the Israelis have all kinds of justifications for that. That's not my point. My point is Israel is a very powerful country, and the Palestinians are relatively weak, and that's not often understood. So you want to talk about responsibility, and you want to talk about failures, and that's what I mainly do in this book. I'm looking at the Palestinian side of things, but I don't think you want to lose sight of the fact that certainly as between the Palestinians and the Israelis, there's a huge imbalance.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Rashid Khalidi. He holds the Edward Said Chair in Arab Studies at Columbia University. Before that, he was Professor of Middle East History and Director of the Center for International Studies at the University of Chicago. He has authored many scholarly articles about the Middle East and a number of books. His most recent is The Iron Cage, the story of the Palestinian struggle for statehood. It's published by the Beacon Press. In addition, he is widely interviewed and sought out for comment on the politics of the Middle East. He's joining us this morning by phone. Questions are welcome. We do have two standing by, and we certainly will get them and others. If you'd like to give us a call, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Our next caller is on line two in Champaign. Hello. Is the caller there, line two in Champaign?
Yes, hi.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, Professor Khalidi, this is Fayyad Sbahat in Champaign. I was hoping you would speak in a comparative manner to the standards that both the Palestinian and Israeli governments are being held to, especially that at least two successive Israeli governments over the past few years have declared George Bush's roadmap to be dead. And at the same time, the Palestinian government is being expected to support it and live up to it at the moment. And most recently, even, the fact that while the Palestinian government is being held in contempt for not recognizing Israel, we have the Israeli government, being a coalition itself, have welcomed in its ranks members of a new members of a Israeli party that openly in its charter called for expulsion of Palestinians from their homeland and basically confining them to nothing more than small ghettos. So I was hoping if you could, you know, speak to the context of the different standards and the expectations from each. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, Professor Khalidi, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the first things that's implicit in your question is that there are two governments, and really there's not. There's an Israeli government, the government of a sovereign state recognized by the world, and there's the Palestinian Authority. Now, Professor Boyle, in his call earlier, said the Palestinians have a state. They have a sort of virtual state. In practice, they don't have a state, and they don't control. They don't have sovereignty over. They don't have jurisdiction over territory. So that's the first thing I would say. But as to the unequal standards, I can only agree with you. The most odious example of it, in my view, was a statement that was made by John Bolton in vetoing a Security Council resolution last Saturday, in which he said that Israeli violence directed against the Palestinians was legitimate. whereas what the Palestinians were doing in firing rockets at Israel was terrorism. So what John Bolton was basically saying was that the use of main battle tanks and attack helicopters and heavy artillery designed for battlefield use against other armies by Israel in the most heavily built-up area in the world, the most heavily populated area in the world, the Gaza Strip, where necessarily, inevitably, and every time it's used, there are civilian casualties, and where nearly 400 people, more than half of them civilians, have been killed since May, is legitimate, but that Palestinian rocket fire into towns in Israel, like Sderot and so forth, and Ashdod, where, as of today, 3 Israeli civilians have been killed, is terrorism. I think that's an example of a standard that is, to me, very hard to understand. By the law of war, any country is entitled to self-defense, but there's a principle of proportionality that has to be kept in mind. And there has to be the understanding that if there's a danger of harming civilians, that has to be taken into account. So I think it can certainly be argued that the firing of rockets into Israel, whether by Hamas or by Hezbollah, is a violation of the laws of war. And you can call it terrorism, you can call it whatever you want, but it's certainly a violation of the laws of war. And it should be condemned. But the use of these battlefield weapons in, you know, hugely overpopulated urban neighborhoods, being called legitimate by our government, it makes me ashamed to be an American, frankly. Now, I know that Bolton, where Bolton comes from, I know the kind of ideology he comes out of. I know that for people like Bolton, this term terrorism covers a multitude of things and justifies a multitude of sins on the part of whoever's acting supposedly against terrorism. But I think this is a monstrous statement. And of course, nobody in the United States even turns a hair, partly because we are not allowed by the media to see the impact of all of this. You turn on any television station anywhere else in the world, including in Israel. And I'm not just talking about Al Jazeera or Al Arabiya, but, you know, generally European television and Arab television and, for that matter, Israeli television. And you see the horrible toll of the use of battlefield weapons, heavy artillery, main battle tanks, and attack helicopters in built-up areas. And, in fact, there were demonstrations in Israel because people were so nauseated by the results of this. In this country, it's not even visible. I mean, I have not seen a single piece of film on any American cable or network television show, a news show, showing the impact of the killing of almost 2 people a day for the last several months in the Gaza Strip. And obviously, there are, I'm sure, very good reasons why this doesn't make it to TV. I know it's very important to know what J-Lo did with I don't know who, or what Brad Pitt did with I don't know what, and this is vital news, and we have to be informed, you know, up to the moment of every personality in the firmament of American glamour. But for some reason, those kinds of things manage to always be covered extensively, and something like this, which I think is important given that the United States is identified with Israel in what it does, and some of these weapons are American, should be at least covered.
All right, well, let's go on, and we'll talk with someone here in Champaign County next, line number 1. Hello.
Thank you. Speaking of what gets on television, I applaud your response on the Lair Hour where you said, were asked what was the most dangerous aspect of the current situation, and you said it was the Bush administration's tendency to lump everything together in one pot, calling Hezbollah, Hamas, calling everybody, the Somalians are now collaborating with the Iranians, we're told that everything is the GWOT, and it was brilliant. I'm waiting for you to be invited back with bated breath. But what I really was motivated to call about was, what do you think of this idea that the attack on Lebanon was co-planned in Cheney's office, that kind of narrative, that whether how much of it was this proxy war idea. The speaker yesterday was candid in saying that, you know, the national security state basically controls the IDF and IDA basically control the policy regarding Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
But what about their collaboration and what credibility do you give to that kind of
mm-hmm.
line?
Well, I mean, I didn't hear yesterday's interview, but I think that I believe it was Zev Maoz who was speaking.
Yes.
I believe that what he said, and many Israeli commentators would agree with this, is that particularly with this weak government, this current weak Israeli government, which has no leading figures in it who are major players in that security establishment, except Avi Dichter, who was the head of the Shabak, the GSS, the General Security Service, the Israeli Internal Security Service. All the rest of them are basically either civilians or people who had served as reservists in low ranks, but none of them were generals, as has been the case for many Israeli prime ministers, and virtually every government since the 60s has had a bunch of generals, or two or three in it. In that circumstance, the security establishment, which has huge influence in any case in Israel, as I think Maoz was saying, pretty much dictated to the government, told them, this is what we're going to do, we have to do this, and the government was in no position to say anything different. You had a new defense minister who has no experience, you had a new prime minister who has very little security experience, and they caved very quickly. What the caller seems to be mainly interested in is the connection with the United States, and I think the connection was primarily ideological rather than in the realm of planning. The vice president's office, which is where most of the bad ideas in the last 6 years have been hatched, in this administration, includes some of the most extreme individuals insofar as the Middle East is concerned. The people who run the vice president's national security establishment, and many of the people who come out of the vice president's office have been planted in other government departments or in the president's own NSC. This lot has been banging the drums for a war on Iran, which is planned as being an air war. And for them, the plan that Israeli General Chalutz, the chief of staff, who himself before that had been chief of staff of the Israeli Air Force, came up with, which was for a mainly air-based war against Hezbollah, was manna from heaven, because it served a dual purpose of knocking out Hezbollah, would have if it worked, have served the dual purpose of knocking out Hezbollah, which is perceived as a force potentially capable of deterring Israel from acting in a situation of a war with Iran, either an American war with Iran or an American-Israeli war with Iran. And secondly, would have been a sort of test run for the planned air campaign against Iran. So at the very least, I think that lot, the people around the vice president, and others who had similar views, people like John Bolton at the United Nations and Cambone over at the Pentagon and Elliot Abrams in the President's National Security Council. All of these people, it's pretty clear, were cheerleading the Israelis, were doing everything possible to prevent any international action to interfere with the Israeli campaign, and saw this as as a proxy war, in which the United States, via Israel, was beating up on an Iranian proxy, but also saw it as sort of the opening salvo in their campaign to make possible a war on Iran. The whole thing obviously came to grief when it was revealed that General Chalutz's plans were mislaid, let's say, and when Hezbollah didn't, fall into the script that was set for it by collapsing under this bombardment. Quite the contrary. The result was a disaster for this general, who probably will have to leave his job, and also for the Israeli government. And I like to think also for the neoconservatives, who suddenly were revealed for what they are, a bunch of prestidigitators behind a screen pulling levers and pulling a fast one over on the American public. And I don't think that the defeat of the Republicans in a week ago had that much to do with Lebanon, but the absolute and utter collapse of the policies that these people have been pushing for the last 6 years, I think, did have something to do with the Democratic victory and the Republican defeat.
What are the implications for Lebanon, and do you think they learned a lesson as far as...
The Lebanese or the Israelis?
Well, I think the U.S. is what I was talking about. If this was the first opening, are they still planning on going ahead?
The plans are still there. I would like to think that the fiasco in Iraq, combined with what happened in Lebanon, makes it much less likely that we could or would launch a war against Iran. But there are people still. I hate to say this. There are people still beating the drums for a war in Iran, and I'm not sure that we're entirely over that. That hill yet.
If I have another follow-up, the near term for Lebanon, what do you see with the breakdown in the cabinet? And
the situation is not good in Lebanon for a variety of reasons. The Syrians, in some respect, can be seen to have initiated this by the pressure they put on the Lebanese constitutional system, followed by the assassination of Hariri, Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri, which they're accused. The United States then used this as an opportunity for regime change, basically, to reverse things in the Middle East that the neoconservative Kool-Aid drinkers have been calling for, just changing regimes up and down the Middle East. And they pushed the Syrians out of Lebanon, which is, in my view, not an entirely bad thing. But at the same time, they've continued to put enormous pressure on Syria. And Syria, as anybody who's ever lived in Lebanon knows, is not a country that it's easy to entirely push out of Lebanon. I mean, it's like saying Mexico and the United States or the United States and Canada. They're very, very close to each other physically and historically and so on. And Syria is a very big, powerful country, and Lebanon is a small country. And there's going to be a tendency of the stronger one to influence the weaker one. And in some cases, that's not a bad thing. In some cases, it is. So you now have a crisis partly caused by that, partly caused by the failure of Israel's war this summer, partly caused by the deep difficulties between the Lebanese, which were pre-existing problems, and partly, as I've already said, caused by our policy, which I think has been very, very foolish. It may change. I'm not sure. It could be that the Baker-Hamilton Commission will inject a dose of realism, but I don't think that the partisans of regime change, war, and using force against the Arabs, because the only thing that the Arabs understand is force, I don't think the partisans of that approach are going to give up without another fight. And they're still deeply entrenched in positions in government, starting with the vice president's office and in other places. I understand that Secretary-designate Gates has made very clear that he's going to kick every one of them out of the Pentagon, which is a consummation devoutly to be hoped for. But there are many of them in other important positions in our government.
5-6 minutes left. Just real quick to introduce again our guest, Rashid Khalidi. He's professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University. Now, President Bush is looking at his last 2 years, and I know that some people are saying he's looking for some kind of positive note to go mm-hmm. out on, and that one possibility would be if he could make some progress in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, that he would try. Do you think that there is some potential there, some interest there in some way that the administration could become positively involved here?
Well, the president would have to demonstrate something that he's never demonstrated before, which is a degree of flexibility, a willingness to admit mistakes, changing very firmly fixed ideas that he has, and relying on people, none of whom he's relied upon from the moment he came into the White House. If he does all of those things, then there's a possibility. Remember, there are other actors out there, each of which can completely upend anybody's forecasts, from the Palestinians and the Israelis to the Syrians and the Iranians to the Egyptians to the Saudis and so on and so forth. But were he to do all of these things, which I personally don't think is terribly likely, I mean, his whole understanding of the Middle East through the prism of terrorism is the problem, insofar as, for example, Syria or the Palestinians are concerned. To see everything, lump everything together, as I've said before, one of the callers mentioned, I said this on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, this idea that Hezbollah and Hamas and Iran and Al-Qaeda are the same, which is an idea that the president and his closest advisors have ceaselessly propagated from day one, and their paid hacks and flacks at Fox News howl about morning to night. That is the problem. As long as you see things that way, you will cause problems in the Middle East. You are the problem. And I would argue that is, unless that whole, they can disabuse themselves of that whole utterly false notion and understand where something like Hezbollah comes from or where something like Hamas comes from and how you deal with that. Right now, to even ask those questions is to be described as a terrorist sympathizer. To actually ask the kind of intelligent questions without which serious policymaking is impossible is to exclude yourself from a certain, you know, realm of discourse in Washington. So they're going to have to make a lot of changes before the policy can get any better, in my view.
Let's see if we can get in quickly one last caller here in the time we have left in Champaign, line one. Hello?
Hi. It's really interesting listening to your guests. I totally agree with his analysis. I think one of the things that the president could do in his last couple of years is push Vice President Cheney out. I think he has been the real force behind the kind of actions and inactions we've taken in the Middle mm-hmm. East. His company, I don't care what anybody says, and it is just appalling to me how we just kind of brush away the fact that Halliburton has made tremendous money over in the Middle East. And if there's not a connection there, then we all are not very smart. Thank you.
Well,
couldn't agree more with the caller on both counts. I think that it's time that the kind of theft in high places that this administration has sanctified end, and I think it really is. The most powerful person in this administration has been the vice president, and as long as he's there, I for one don't sleep easy.
Well, it doesn't just as I hate to end on a note like this, but it doesn't sound like anything is likely to change anytime soon.
Well, remember the president's father and his advisors seem to have read the riot act to the president, and the president understands one thing if he understands nothing else, and it's American politics, and he got what he himself described as a thumping. Everything he's said and done in those 6 years has been repudiated from beginning to end by the electorate. 55-odd% of the voters told him that he was wrong. So he does understand that. That and the fact that people like Baker and Gates, whatever one may think of them, are a lot more realistic than anybody who's been anywhere near a lever of power in Washington for the past 6 years, or maybe some small cause for hope.
Our guest is Rashid Khalidi. He's the Edward Said Chair, holds the Edward Said Chair in Arab Studies at Columbia. Before that, taught for a number of years at University of Chicago. He's written widely about the Middle East. His new book is The Iron Cage, The Story of the Palestinian Struggle for Statehood. It's published by the Beacon Press. Professor Khalidi, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.